This is Building Bridges, your community and labor report, produced and hosted by Ken Nash and Mimi Rosenberg.
Later on Building Bridges, how much security did $1 trillion buy? You'll hear part six in an ongoing series, Rethink Afghanistan, by Robert Greenwald and Brave New Films.
But first, a cowboy mentality and racial profiling prevailed as armed federal immigration agents illegally stormed into homes of Latinos in New York and New Jersey in hundreds of pre-dawn raids.
The raids violated the agents' own agency rules as well as the Constitution. According to the newly released study by the Benjamin Cardozo School of Law, Constitution on Ice, Immigration Home Raids.
We're joined by Peter Markowitz from the Cardozo Immigration Justice Clinic and co-author of the study.
How are you?
Good. I want to begin by contextualizing this issue of ICE agents illegally entering homes without legal authority. How does that connect back to the edicts of the Bush administration, and where does what they think, in any event, the authority came from for them to do that?
Home raids have been a part of immigration enforcement for a very long time, but something kind of dramatic happened in 2006 that made them much more of a focus of the federal immigration authority's enforcement tactics and really led to an explosion in the use of home raids and also in the misconduct that we document in the report. Politically, it stemmed from the Bush administration's misguided judgment that the way to push comprehensive immigration reform was to allow their enforcement strategy to be driven politically instead of by sound policy. And so they ramped up their enforcement operations in an effort to show high numbers, which they thought would maybe gain them the political will to pass comprehensive immigration reform. Unfortunately, there was a severe miscalculation. And on a more technical level, what happened is there was a series of policy memoranda that were issued by the agency in 2006, which dramatically altered the quota system for these internal enforcement teams and incentivized the kind of illegal conduct that we document in the report. And I can give you some details on that if that would be
Please
helpful.
Please do.
So prior to, these are seven-person elite immigration enforcement teams that were billed to Congress as teams that were to be used to go after the worst of the worst. They were supposed to go after terrorists and people who were violent criminals who posed some significant danger to society. But in 2006, when they were under pressure to show higher arrest numbers, they made some changes that led to some significant policy drift. What they did is, prior to 2006, these teams had to arrest 125 targets, these kind of high-priority targets a year. Overnight, in 2006, they inflated their arrest quotas eightfold. So these same seven-person teams suddenly had to arrest 1,000 people. Simultaneously, they allowed them now to count not only targets, but any arrests at all that they made. So what this did is it incentivized officers to get into homes by any means necessary and arrest anybody they can put their hands on who was in violation of even civil provisions of the immigration law. So not surprisingly, their efficiency at capturing the people that they purported to be going after, these dangerous targets, plummeted. And what we saw instead were widespread constitutional violations and the arrest of kind of mere immigrant workers.
And what were the constitutional violations perpetrated by the federal agents?
But one of the primary violations is, you know, the Fourth Amendment of our Constitution protects all sorts of kind of privacy realms. But the core of what it protects, the kind of centerpiece of what the framers had in mind, was your physical integrity in your home. And what happened in these cases was violations that go to the very heart of the Fourth Amendment. The agency itself admits that they don't have authority to be entering these homes without consent. They admit that they don't use judicial warrants. But their own records revealed that in an alarming percentage of cases, we're talking upwards of 80% of cases of home raids in Long Island and over a quarter of home raids in New Jersey, they were doing just that. They were breaking into homes in flagrant violation of the Fourth Amendment, just as common burglars do.
How did these things happen? What was the impact, and what did it look like for those people in these pre-dawn hours who one would think were asleep? Just give it that human element.
That's an important part of the story, is that you can kind of get lost in the statistics, but one of the things we try to do in the report is document as many kind of individual cases as possible, people who've been willing to be public about their stories. Typically, these happen 4:30 or 5 in the morning, under cover of darkness, when everybody in the home is still asleep. Teams of seven-person teams of immigration agents will screech to a halt in front of the apartment in their cars. Oftentimes, a local police cruiser is also sorry about that.
I guess we have a young constitutional prospect there who's chiming in.
So they screech to a halt. They oftentimes have a local police cruiser parked outside to kind of give the impression that this is a local police operation. They'll initially bang on the doors yelling police from all kind of surrounding the house, and will try to see if there are any open doors, any open windows. If they are, the reports have that they're climbing in through open windows. We have reports of them entering through unlocked doors. If somebody comes to the door, typically what seems to happen in these raids is the moment the door is cracked open, the officers will storm into the house, sweep the entire house, immediately seize and cuff anybody who appears to them to be Latino, is what the statistics kind of bear out, and we can get into that, and bring them to a centralized place in the house and begin questioning them about their immigration status.
And since you mentioned that, Professor, the racial or ethnic profiling or stereotyping or appearance, or am I putting that into it, or is that really part of the mix? And if so, how is that documented, that that was a fundamental feature that precipitated these raids?
It certainly was. And it was something kind of anecdotally we had been hearing for quite some time. But in trying to do kind of a systematic study to see if the numbers really bore this out or whether these were mere anecdotes, what we did is we took the arrest reports, and we looked at over 700 arrest reports in total. And we took the arrest reports, and we compared the ethnicities of the people who are arrested as targets, the people who they claimed to be actually going out after. And we compared that to the ethnicities of the people who they arrested as what they call collaterals, people who they claimed they just happened to encounter. And one would presume that the ethnic breakdown among the two groups should be roughly the same, right? Hmm. Because the homes that they're going into, the targets, should be a good reflection of the ethnicities of the homes and of the communities they're going into. But what we found was a very significant disparity between the representation of Latinos in those two groups. Only 2/3 of the targets arrested were Latino, but approximately 90% of the people arrested as collaterals were Latino. What that suggests is when the immigration agents encounter someone who appears to them to be Latino, they're stopping them and investigating their immigration status. But if they see somebody who appears to them not to be Latino, they're not, and those people walk away. And that initial seizure, based solely on ethnicity, is a violation of our Constitution. It's the Fifth Amendment of the Constitution.
Were the supposed targets just excuses for picking up large numbers of immigrants, or did they really try to get at these supposed targets and then they didn't find them, arrested anybody in the household?
Right. I mean, the numbers seem to suggest that they're, you know, initially, certainly prior to the quota changes in 2006, there's no reason to think that these teams were uninterested in their targets. But what happened post-2006 is that they seem to be equally interested in any arrest they can make. And the low-hanging fruit is, of course, just undocumented workers and much, much easier to locate. And so the way this played out is immigration agents would seemingly not care at all whether the intelligence they had that an individual target was at a location was good intelligence or stale intelligence, because all they really cared about was getting in that door and making as many arrests as possible. We impaneled a law enforcement advisory panel, and it's one of the things that they were most taken aback at was the monumental waste of resources. Even if you just credit that this is a valid enforcement initiative and that going after these targets is a valid enforcement initiative, and I think we could back up and think about actually what categories they're labeling as targets, because I think there's some overbreath there as well. But even if you just accept that, the way they went about it, the kind of shotgun approach to enforcement, was extraordinarily wasteful, because in a large percentage of cases, they simply did not find the target in the home. And in fact, over two-thirds of the people that they ended up arresting were not targets at all, but were what they deemed collaterals.
So I was also interested in the supposition that this was in violation of the agency's own rules, which is interesting. So what does that lead us to think or believe about the, is this individual license? Is this indeed just attitudinal behavior on the part of individuals? Or does the agency deliberately turn a blind eye? I mean, how do you evaluate the fact that there were regulations which were systematically violated?
You have to say at least two things about it. One is, when you see violations of the agency's own rules, and there is no doubt from the top of the agency that they acknowledge that entering homes without consent, without judicial warrants, are violations not only of their own policies, but the Constitution. There's no kind of fine point disagreement. These are very clear-cut constitutional violations. So when you have that kind of clear understanding from the top of the agency, but such systemic violations in the field, the first thing you have to look at is a monumental failure of supervision and training. And that's why one category of the recommendations in this report all go to supervision and training. But a second thing I think that this goes to is, this is really the population that's being policed here is one of the most marginalized populations in our nation. And the normal tools that we use as a society to check police abuse have short-circuited and really failed in this instance. Things like suppression motions, where in a regular criminal proceeding, if the police violate the Constitution, that can be litigated in a criminal proceeding and the evidence suppressed, and that serves as a real check. But because of some Supreme Court jurisprudence and some factors about the nature of immigration proceedings, suppression motions don't play any kind of deterrent, significant deterrent role here. And other kind of traditional tools to check police abuse, like civil liability, are equally kind of impotent here when you have a population that is, by comparison, largely unfamiliar with the American legal system, and that often is, frankly, deported before they have the opportunity to try to remedy the abuses that they've suffered. So we have a real lack of systematic ways to check the abuses, and that's another place that this report kind of goes in terms of its recommendations, is how do we strengthen those kind of traditional checks and bring them into this realm and end the kind of lawless policing that has now become commonplace here.
Did you get any reaction from the current Homeland Security Department about the report or the recommendations?
Yes, sadly we haven't. We had reached out to the administration several months ago to kind of offer to preview our findings for them and to work with them towards developing some policy recommendations, and despite kind of multiple efforts to reach out to them, never got a response.
And what are some of those most salient recommendations before we tell people where they can get a copy of the report online and they need to study it carefully, because obviously our democracy is only as strong as the preservation of our constitutional rights, which have been sorely violated?
First, we have to kind of understand the scope of the problem. We were able to obtain, because of some Freedom of Information Act lawsuits, a large sample of arrest reports from New York and New Jersey. There's reason to believe that the kind of widespread violations that we saw in New York and New Jersey are part of a national phenomenon. But that needs further study, and the agency that really should be doing that study is the Department of Homeland Security's Office of Inspector General. So as a starting point, that seems like a no-brainer. Right, that we need to have a little bit further understanding of the scope of the problem we're dealing with. But then, and this is a recommendation that came directly from our law enforcement advisory panel, they are just monumentally overusing this very, very heavy-handed tactic. There may be a place to use home raids, but that place is for people who truly do pose a threat to national security or really are violent criminals who may pose a threat to their communities. And in those instances, it may be appropriate. In other instances, home raids should be off the table. In those circumstances where the agency is going to use home raids, it should play by the same rules that every other law enforcement agency in the country plays by. They should go get judicial warrants. That would obviate the need for consent and eliminate most of the constitutional issues that are highlighted in the report. So those are just kind of a handful of the recommendations that came out of the report.
And it's a very readable, digestible, and important report. Professor Markowitz, where can people get a copy?
You can get it for free on our website if you go to www.cardozo, that's C-A-R-D-O-Z-O, .yu.edu/immigrationjustice.
And I think you can just also put on Constitution on Ice, Immigration Home Raids in Google, and I believe
it'll
probably come up. And Professor Markowitz, most importantly, thank you for working on this critical study, and thank you for speaking with us this evening, and thank the little one who was eager, clearly, to contribute to the discussion, and I'm sure is a budding constitutional lawyer.
He'll be on next
Certainly
week.
Certainly not.
She'll be on next week, right?
Thank you very much, Professor.
Thanks so much.
Peter Markowitz with the Cardozo Immigration Justice Clinic.
And now, the war in Afghanistan is increasing the likelihood that American civilians will be killed in a future terrorist attack. Three former high-ranking CIA agents on the record explain why there is no victory to be won in Afghanistan. Now, part six of the ongoing series, Rethink Afghanistan, How Much Security Did $1 Trillion Buy? By Robert Greenwald and Brave New Films.
What's happening now in Afghanistan, we used to call this mission creep. We went from hunting Al-Qaeda now to, if you like, nation building, or in this case, destroying people in the Taliban, whatever the Taliban is. I mean, the Taliban did not attack us on 9/11. They were simply the equivalent of a hotel operator that had a very bad guest that committed a crime, and now we're going after the hotel and the hotel operator.
Both wars have made the Middle East and the world much more dangerous for Americans and for any American presence overseas.
Terrorism has increased worldwide in the past 7 years, and we've spent a tremendous amount of treasure and blood to achieve a result of increased terrorism.
Specifically, as we've gone forward to try to increase our control of the country with more troops and concentrating that control in the heartland of the Pashtuns, the areas most sympathetic to the Taliban, what we've seen is an increase in anti-American and anti-Western suicide and other violence, not a decline.
It's creating much greater hostility towards the United States and creating a whole lot more people that would be happy to kill Americans or join in some kind of terrorist operation.
We are getting less safe. Our lives are getting more dangerous. We are coming closer and closer into the crosshairs of a group of people who hate us because our government is bombing them.
These policies are making people who hate us and who have the arms and means to attack us more emboldened and more in a hurry, more impatient to carry out their attack because we're coming.
Our invasion of Afghanistan, what it's doing is causing us greater danger, no question about it, because what's happening is the more we fight in Afghanistan, the more the conflict is pushed across the border into Pakistan, the more we destabilize Pakistan, the more likely it is that a fundamentalist government will take over the army, will be in charge, or at least a couple officers, and will have Al-Qaeda-like groups with nuclear weapons.
We're involved right now in Afghanistan in a counterinsurgency campaign.
Today, we continue to fight the Taliban, principally because they see us as occupiers of their country, and we see them as potentially creating a situation where either bin Laden or others might find sanctuary in the future. That's the principal reason we're focused on the Taliban, but as far as they're concerned, we are occupying their country.
We are going after ethnic Pashtuns who are fighting the central government in Kabul. We are in the middle of a civil war. And that's what we are. We are fighting a civil war. We are fighting to build a nation in Afghanistan, a nation that maybe the Afghans don't want. I'm not sure.
Al-Qaeda and the Taliban are groups with completely distinct ideologies and goals. The Taliban is a very locally oriented movement. Its main concern is within the borders of Afghanistan. Its main concern is to kick out the Americans, whereas Al-Qaeda has much more of a vision of global jihad.
Pressure on both has tended to fuse the two of them together. But again, I do want to caution that they are separate organizations, and we're making a mistake if we think of them as being manifestations of the same organization.
The Taliban are domestically motivated. By and large, they are conservative Pashtun people who want to take control of bits of Afghan territory and implement their own social and religious codes in Afghan territory, but do not have a primary interest in mounting terrorist attacks in the United States.
Al-Qaeda is a very specific international organization that was born in Pakistan in 1988, has operated continuously for 21 years or so since then, and it draws its membership from all over the world. Its most important characteristic is its global membership and agenda.
The Taliban are not Al-Qaeda.
The Taliban don't have an international agenda.
They're mounting what they see as a form of national liberation movement, and they're not, you know, strung around the world randomly blowing up civilians for some kind of shadowy international purpose.
They don't have an intention to put a bomb in New York or London or Madrid. They would. They have a local agenda, and they see themselves more as nationalists.
Our primary objective, as has been articulated by President Obama, is to defeat Al-Qaeda. In fact, Al-Qaeda does really not have a very substantial presence within Afghanistan.
Al-Qaeda is no longer in Afghanistan. They are not in Kandahar. They are not out in the desert. They are not in any part of Afghanistan. They've moved, but we are still fighting a war that the enemy's not even there. It's crazy.
Not so very long ago, General David Petraeus admitted that what I'm saying, which is that there's not much of an Al-Qaeda presence in Afghanistan, if any at all.
No Al-Qaeda at all in Afghanistan. Is that an exaggeration, General Petraeus, or is that true?
No, I would agree with that assessment.
We are fighting a war for empty buildings that Al-Qaeda used to occupy. And what we're saying is, now we own the hotel and you're not coming back in. It's a silly notion.
One of the biggest points is that U.S. has to know how to fight Al-Qaeda, because U.S. is fighting in the way, the classic way. The classic war is not appropriate for a non-classic enemy, because Al-Qaeda is not a classic kind of enemy. To have a force, to have a place, to have a location, and to have an army.
The whole idea that somehow if you smash the cave, that there will be no terrorist attack is incredible.
Current administration and the previous one have sought routinely the central front of the war on terror. There is no central front of the war on terror. It's not that type of war. If you want to use that type of logic and language, I think we'd have to say that the central front is actually the borders of our country. And the real problem when we think forward from 9/11 is not that Al-Qaeda found sanctuary in Afghanistan, it's that a sufficient number of their people found sanctuary here.
There's a growing body of work that suggests that the real way to defeat terrorism is through police work, anti-criminal work. There's a study by the Rand Corporation a few months ago that came out with this conclusion. They studied insurgencies from many different countries around the world and found that most of them sort of petered off and died for very different reasons, but none of them actually were, or very few of them were actually defeated by an invading army, because that usually causes a host of other problems and it doesn't actually solve the original problem.
I don't think that a major conventional military force which whatever its strategic intent is going to look to local people like a colonizing occupation army is going to succeed in the long run in Afghanistan.
The kinds of intelligence operations, police operations, special forces operations, which targeted people who had an international terrorist agenda, whose objective was to mount attacks against the United States, seems perfectly justifiable and achievable. It's within our gift.
What we can do there, and in that area generally, is focus on monitoring al-Qaeda, interdicting al-Qaeda, disrupting al-Qaeda. This we can do relatively successfully, and it doesn't require that we deploy what I think eventually will be 100,000 NATO and U.S. troops on the ground.
If you do not, level with the American people before you enter into a hostile environment, and you give them the impression that this thing can be done cost-free, you're going to lose their support.
Let's continue, by all means, to focus on defensive counter-terrorist operations, which are really not very different from the kind of disruption operations that you'd undertake against a criminal group in your own country, but not get involved in trying to occupy large swathes of Afghanistan in the vain hope that you can win a counterinsurgency.
We will be there, the way things are going now, for 50 years. It will always have the potential to be a base for terrorism, but the alternative that this administration is offering us, and Washington in general, everybody in Washington, is we just stay there forever.
The struggle against terrorism is an existential condition. Neither you nor I will live to see it won. The sooner we in the United States understand that we cannot achieve complete security, and we certainly can't achieve it anytime soon, the sooner we accept that, the sooner we move to policies that can help us get more security and that are achievable.
Well, this has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg
and Ken Nash. And log on to our new website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.